I wonder what you think.
Of the professor's proposition that human existence and suffering are one and the same thing, that they are a description of one another. To say that you exist is to say you suffer. To say that you suffer is to say that you exist. That's his core belief about the question of suffering and human destiny, which is an enormous question.
This is not a right answer, wrong answer question on my part, by the way. I actually do want to know what you think about that.
I think he's right.
Tell me more.
I think that's what the Bible tells us too, is that this is, humans are fallen, and that left to our own devices, we will grow.
So the professor's position that he's come to is that this is the summation of the question, that human existence and suffering are one and the same, and to end your human existence is to do no more and no less than to end your human suffering. So for him, the big drink of whiskey is stepping in front of the Sunset Limited. It's in one of the pictures that's always stuck in my imagination. It's the picture of human existence that says, if when we're alive, we're like a light bulb, the end of human existence is roughly equivalent to just letting the light bulb go and it hits the floor and it shatters, and that's the end of the story. So that's where the professor lives. Suffering and human existence are one and the same, full stop. Is there anything more to human existence than suffering? And if so, what might that be?
Funny coming back from Japan and hearing you say that, because in Japan, that's Buddhism, right? It's essentially, he is, it's a restatement of Buddhism.
Yep.
It's one of the truths that life is suffering.
Yes.
And the way to get rid of suffering is to realize that you don't have self, and to realize that there is nothing, that we are all part of the void, as they call it. And one prophet I was listening to talk about that, he was actually a Catholic prophet, so he was coming from a Christian perspective, he said, it's a good way to deal with the problem of suffering. The problem is that if there's no self there, because the idea is to get rid of suffering by realizing there's no self, but if there's no self there to suffer, there's also no self there to love.
Yes.
And so he said the Christian idea of what it is. Because frankly, even when I've been very open to other religions' ideas and listening closely to what Buddhism has to say, I end up going, it's a very depressing and pessimistic, worldview. And I've got to say, in Christianity, you find the hope that there is a person who is love and who rests in us and gives us something to love. You know, the love is what disrupts that kind of thing.
Intriguing that the culture, which can sustain and be sustained by those Four Noble Truths, among other teachings of the Buddha, is deeply communal culture. And I'm very intrigued, and this is just, we won't go down this path now, you and I can talk later maybe, but I'm very intrigued to watch what happens to that culture's ability to sustain itself under that belief system as it's impacted by the West's individualism. Because I think being in a common void, is actually one of the things that makes that system sustainable. Take away the communal aspect of being alone together, being in the void together, boom. Like there's going to be a collapse of the ability to live that ideology, because it depends on company, yeah. Which is actually acted love.
We're all alone together.
Yes, yeah. So anyway, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the East as the West spills over. If it does, it might flow the other way. Maybe I'm just got my empirical, you know, echo machine going here. Better watch it. What sort of perspective on suffering does Black's character have? Here's a guy who suffered. We skipped the portion of the film where he tells his conversion story, which is an extremely violent part of the film, not in terms of physical violence, but he tells the white, the professor asks Black to tell him a jailhouse story, and he keeps pushing and pushing and pushing until Black finally does. And the story he tells him is a story of his conversion, which is a story of a full-on brawl that happens in the cafeteria one day when some guy pushes him in the line and a couple of people snap and things get crazy and he rips a leg off a table and just beats this guy almost to death. And he tells the story with a lot of intensity. And this other guy comes to the first guy's aid and stabs him a whole bunch of times, almost cuts him in half. That's what he was referring to. Some nigga tried to core me like an apple. That's what that line is about in the clip we watched today. And as he's lying in the infirmary, stitched back together, almost dead from this brawl, he hears the voice of God. And that's sort of the nugget, the center of his conversion story. So here's a guy, all that to say, here's a guy who has suffered, and who, if we look at his life as represented by his apartment and his laborer's occupation and so on and so forth, some of these cultural signals, we might say, here's a guy who still knows what it's like to live in suffering. And the professor questions that later in the film and just says, how can you live in this, you know, this hellhole?
I think there's a certain aspect that he's trying to get at about our involvement in suffering. And I think sometimes we make our own hell where we are, despite our circumstances.
Hmm.
So this professor probably has a well-paying job, probably can afford anything he wants. Doesn't seem to maybe have any health problems, and yet feels that his life is suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And there's that act of will, I think, that allows us to feel like we're suffering, and there's an act of will that allows us to feel that we're enduring hardship, but not necessarily suffering.
Or even if we are suffering, that it's not the entire story. What do you guys think of the professor's idea of measuring happiness against suffering? How would you even know if you were happy if you didn't have something to measure it against? That's a paraphrase, but that's essentially the argument he makes.
There's a lot of perspective involved with it. I was just reminded of one of my friends went to Ecuador at one point. I was just amazed by how little the people there had and yet how happy they were in spite of that.
Hmm.
Like, she was struck that there was more happiness there than she would see in a lot of here. And so that sort of, if one, some of us were put in that position, we might start to think that our life is terrible and all we know is suffering. But it's a matter of perspective, maybe, what you make you happy and what you think you need.
These are such tension-filled ideas, aren't they? Like, every one of them has tension in it. Ease is not the same thing as happiness. Wealth is not the same thing as happiness. Suffering, Black is arguing, is not the death of happiness. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? He would argue, if we let him run his course, that many of the things that we consume to blunt our suffering, the things that we say we want because we are afraid that we can't have what we really want, which his argument says is the love of God, that because we are afraid we can't have the thing that we're most hungry for, we will turn to things that if you ask us outright, do you really want this? We'd say no, but I'll have another. And I'm going to go get another bottle of it or another jar of it or another car of it or another whatever of it because I'm afraid I'll run out. I'd rather die from it than face the fear that I might not be able to get the thing that my soul is the most hungry for. There's a line between that kind of thinking and many of the behaviors in our lives that take the shape of addiction. Things that we do that we know flat out, if you asked us straight to our face in an honest moment, we would say, yep, that's the stuff of death. That's the stuff of self-destruction and the destruction of love. And it's bad news. I'll have another. Even when I don't want to, I'll have another. Black's perspective that happiness and suffering are not antithetical, but actually live in a tension-filled relationship, a meaningful tension-filled relationship with one another, is a very, very significant idea. And I think it's deeply consistent, which Tim alluded to already in some of what he said, I think it's deeply consistent with the shape of our sacred text. Let me give you an example. In Isaiah chapter 40, the prophet's kind of at his wit's end. What do I say? What do I say to these people? This is my job. I'm supposed to speak, and I don't know what to say. Voice says, cry out. And I said, what shall I cry? I'm good to go. What's the message? This is what you shall cry, Isaiah. All people are like grass, and all their faithfulness is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, and the flowers fall, because the breath of the Lord blows on them. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, and the flowers fall. But the word of our God endures forever. It's an interesting text because, among other things, it delineates the two basic affirmations concerning the human condition. And those two affirmations, if we're going to think about this idea set as having a continuum, at one end of the continuum is this idea that suffering is real, and that suffering is the existential lot of humanity. To be human is to suffer is to be human. So that's one pole on this, if you want. And the prophet talks about that. All flesh is grass, surely the people are grass, right? But also, the text that we just read says that suffering is not the last word about the human condition, and therefore, suffering, although it's a great concern of ours as humans, it's not actually our ultimate concern. And the way that the prophet says that in this particular text is to say that the word of our God will stand forever. Proportionately, it's an interesting text, isn't it? There's an awful lot of withering and drying up and being blown away, and God's not absent in the blowing away, which is also curious. Proportionately, there's a lot more of that than there is of affirmation, but they're both there. It's a hard tension to articulate, and I think it'd be fair to say it's an even harder tension to live in. This is a hard idea. If those are the poles between which human spirituality moves, let's give them names, those two positions, if you want. And on the one side, let's name that pole, the pole that says to be human and to suffer are the same thing. Let's name that pole cynicism for the purpose of our conversation. And if the other pole is to say no to suffering, God's all about alleviating suffering, Let's call that pole credulity. And we'll come back to that in a moment. Cynicism resolves the tension between the two ideas by affirming that only one side of the tension, suffering, is real. Period. So that's where the cynic ends up. That's all that's real, is suffering. On the other side, credulity, and just for our purposes again, let me give us a definition. Let's think of credulity as readiness or willingness to believe, especially on slight or uncertain evidence. Okay? So this is a certain shape of belief. Credulity resolves the tension by insisting on seeing only the positive side. Suffering has been overcome by God, so in some way it's a thing to be dismissed, or even perhaps, and you can find tons of Christian writing that goes down this path, that says that basically suffering is an illusion. Let me expand that just a little bit, because to say it that abruptly kind of feels like, oh yeah, well, we all know that's not true. It's not that hard to dismiss that. Any teaching that suggests that if we're suffering, we do so because we lack faith is making the argument that suffering is illusory. It's making the argument that the only reason we're suffering is because we do not fully see the world the way that God sees it, because the way that God sees it does not have suffering in it. And if we saw it like God did, we wouldn't be suffering. Okay? Now, do you recognize contemporary Western theology in that idea? It's not that uncommon. So So those are the poles. Now, I'm gonna suggest to you that faith, because credulity is a religious response, okay? It's a very common religious response to the question of suffering. I'm going to suggest to you, though, that faith is something different than credulity. I'm going to suggest to you that faith is something different than a readiness or willing to believe on slight or uncertain evidence. I'm going to suggest to you that faith is distinct from both of those poles because faith knows that it has to live with tension. Faith knows that this is not actually resolvable by either of those positions in a satisfactory way. If we get stuck solely on the reality of suffering, and we say suffering is all there is, one of the things we have to do to hold that position is we have to live in denial that there are moments of life that are almost pure joy. There are moments of life that are almost pure pleasure. We have to find a way to dismiss that part of reality in order to hold the position that suffering and human existence are the sum of one another. We just have to find a way to deny those things. And there are parts of our life experience, I believe, that are full of beauty and full of goodness and full of truth. Sometimes they're moments, they're split seconds. Sometimes, in our culture especially, I think some of us enjoy whole seasons of that. What a wonder. One of the things I enjoy reading here in Winnipeg's art scene is a magazine called Dig, which is a little magazine basically driven by the faculty of jazz studies at the University of Manitoba and Steve Kirby and his crew. And Kirby, as editor of that magazine, and the head of that faculty, writes this little editorial at the front end of Dig every issue. Thoughtful guy. I asked Luke, I guess he could give you a much more well-rounded picture of Steve Kirby as an educator and a musician and a human being than I can, but my encounters with him have revealed somebody who really does consider life fairly deliberately and deeply, and his essays reflect that. His essay in this, our editorial in this month's issue of Dig, he talks about coming out of the house and seeing his young son, Solomon, on the front lawn, just with his arms up in the air, just dancing in a circle, like all big grin on his face, just all happy. And Kirby basically says, maybe it's because the sun finally came out after, you know, days of rain. And he starts to think and consider in the essay, what would it be like for me as a grown man to behave like that, you know? And what have I lost that I would think it was just completely ridiculous to consider engaging with joy and that kind of celebration of life without measuring it by all these other external standards, but just going, whoa, yeah, joy. I'm going to dance now. You can think whatever you want because I'm not thinking about what you're thinking. I'm thinking about joy. So we have these moments in our life. Whether we fence them in or whether we fall into them, we have them. And so we have to make an account for those when we're thinking about this question. We have to somehow deal with the fact that pain does not erase the memory of shared laughter. And that even when we face something as substantial, as heavy duty as death, that we can encounter love in the midst of death. We can encounter just pure courage in the face of those things. We can encounter the best of humanity in the middle of death. Does that make death not suffering? No, it doesn't. It just means that that's not all it is. It just means that that's not all it is. Huh. To hold to the position of the cynic that life is suffering means that we have to choose to ignore all of that. Now, it's interesting how near the position of the cynic the biblical writers come, because they come right to the edge of that. And I think pretty unapologetically, all flesh is grass and its beauty is like the flower of the field, is some of the poetry of our Christian sacred text. And that's dancing right on the line of that, isn't it? We just traveled across the prairies both ways, 3 weeks apart in July. And we're driving one way and what we see is all these fields ripe, ready for harvest, golden, just beautiful, beginning of daylight, end of daylight. Man, if that doesn't move your soul, check your soul for its general condition, because there is something about that that just... on the trip back, most of it's lying in the swath or has been picked up already out of the swath and it's gone and somebody's burning the stubble. Which visually, at least, I understand there are good nurturant reasons for some of those practices, but visually, at least, it feels like that. There goes the thing that stirred my soul, laying down and taken up for our sustenance, you know. And so we live there, right? The interesting thing is how, although the writers of our sacred text not only had to account for the fading of the flower, for the death of the flower, they also had to account for its blooming. They're not let off the hook in accounting for the other part of the story. And to me, that's one of the things that keeps the hope alive. Consider the lilies, says our own poet. Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor they spin. And yet, the most ridiculously beautiful or opulent or stunning thing we could make as human beings at the height of our powers is not arrayed like one of these. Will it wither and dry up? Yeah. Is it in full bloom? And does it take our breath away and stir our soul and make us wonder just what's really going on in the world? Yeah, it does. These things are not mutually exclusive. That creative things cease, that creative things are extremely vulnerable, is part of the tradition that we stand in as Christians. That's just there in the story. And that is a painful kind of knowing. There's a wrench in our soul to name that and to be honest about it. But that things are, that things exist and have being in the first place, that there is something and that's not nothing, that there is a life-giving being in the midst of all of this, at the heart of the story, this is what keeps even the most sensitively realistic of human beings from completely and finally embracing the way of the cynic. There's just something at the heart of this story that is in denial of the idea that there is no more to life as a human being than suffering. Now, if we go to the opposite pole, we have something equally problematic, because to affirm that God is good in a way that turns a blind eye to the actual suffering of human beings and human communities and offers some kind of theory about how that suffering is only temporary or it's illusory or it's a cultural lag and when the good culture finally catches up with the pagan culture, it'll eliminate the suffering, or that it's something that can be dealt with by technology or consumption, or like there's all these idea sets around this, right? Any of those kind of ideas, or the idea, and here's a classic one, Zenith of Modernity kind of idea, that suffering is being progressively overcome. All of those ideas live in denial of the Christian tradition's refusal to ignore the cry of one child in pain. To ignore the suffering of one subsumed or oppressed culture. To ignore those that are sidelined by the building of empire. The Christian tradition has never allowed that to be part of the core of the tradition. And that, I think, is why we find Jesus telling the kind of stories that he told. We find him telling the story in Matthew 18 or Luke 15 about the finding of one lost sheep. Now, I know lots of us have heard these stories as being stories about making it in by the skin of our teeth, you know. But I want you to listen to Jesus telling this story as he tells it in Luke 15 from the vantage point of what we've been talking about, the question of suffering and human destiny. Okay? So, not heaven and hell. Now the tax collectors and sinners, and our English translators have put quotation marks around sinners. You know what quotation marks mean? They mean we're not quite sure what that word means in this context. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." No quotation marks around sinners. Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. And then he calls his friends and neighbors together and he says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Jesus frames this story in terms of sin and repentance because of who he's talking to. The Pharisees have an unambiguous idea about sinner. The writer of the Gospel of Luke finds himself in a different position. It's very interesting. When it comes to the question of suffering and human destiny, Jesus is telling a story here that says, walking in the way of Jesus does not allow us to go to either pole. To the pole of the cynic that says there is no more to life than suffering, or to the pole of credulity, of easy belief, that says Jesus has come so that all suffering will dry up and blow away. No, 99% of life might be good. How awesome to have 99 sheep in the fold. That's wealth. That's relative ease. That's comfort. That's security. That's all sorts of good things. It's very hard to make the argument that having enough and not having to worry about having enough is not good in some way. But there's one that's suffering in an acute, visible, undeniable way. And the way of Jesus is the way that says, that's not acceptable. That's a thing to chase down. That's a thing to struggle with. That's a thing to engage in. Like lots of biblical stories, what's left out of the compressed nature of parables is the suffering of the Savior. In Luke's gospel, in this parable, we don't have a single detail about the finding of that sheep. We do not have an account of the search. We do not have an account of the terrain. We do not have an account of the thorns. We do not have an account of the condition of the shepherd having finally dug the sheep out of wherever it got its dumbass self into and put it on his shoulder so he could bring it home. It's not there. Why isn't it there? Well, partly it's not there so that we can understand that this is our story. Partly it's not there so that we can understand that this is our path and that the shape of us when we get in there and go after the things that are about suffering, whether they're in our lives or somebody else's life, are going to inflict unique wounds on us because they will call us to share in that suffering. This is what is missing from the professor's world. And if you were here and you saw the clip where he tries to describe his utter lack of friendships, you heard him describe it. He doesn't have any friends. There's no love. There's nothing to sustain him in the face of this enormous question of suffering. So one of the reasons why I keep going on my rants about the communal nature of the story that we call the gospel, we actually need one another. And as soon as we start to take seriously the idea that God is a suffering being rather than a triumphal being who exists to eradicate suffering in all its forms, in all of our experience, then we can start to consider the idea that the cross is actually God crying with us. Then we can actually start to take seriously the idea that when Jesus gets down on his knees, stripped, almost naked, and picks up a basin and a towel to do the job that the most menial beings of the culture were not there to do in that moment. And he just takes it on as though it was a matter of course. But that's exactly the intersection between these poles. That is the way of Christ. And it's the way God is with us. So when we come to God and we're suffering and we say, God, get me out of this suffering, that's the most understandable prayer in the world, isn't it? Who wouldn't pray, God, get me out of this suffering? You got to have a pathology to say, God, give me some more. On the other hand, partly because we've lived perhaps with the idea, the illusion, that what the goodness of God means is that we will not suffer for so long and in so many ways, we neglect to consider the prayer, God, show me how you are suffering with me in this and how my suffering might be like yours. It's a thought. The story of the cross, of course, we often understand the cross as a symbol of triumph, and I don't think that's inappropriate, but where we miss it sometimes is we understand it as a sort of symbol that ignores the cries of the suffering as a symbol, rather than that it's a symbol of God crying with those that are suffering. And the dark days that follow the death of Christ in that story, they're not the only days in the story, but they are days in the story. And the resurrection part of the story does not make the dark days of the story go away. They go together. They coexist. That's the shape of the story that we are called to engage when we are called to walk in the way of Christ. And so in this life, we find ourselves with both sorrow and joy. We find ourselves with both doubt and hope. We find ourselves with both trust and skepticism. And when God comes to us, it's in the midst of those kind of tensions. It's in the midst of those kind of things that kind of keep the string of our search taut, keep us looking toward God. It's in the midst of those kind of things that we experience the much deeper, more profound version of what Taya offered me in the kitchen that summer morning. We experience both the embrace, the come on in here, I couldn't love you more, and also the truth of the matter. All's not as it might be. All's not as we might wish it to be. And all of that, somehow contained within the embrace of God.